listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from the Latin America Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Well, let's jump right in. Maybe a couple of reports on some of the local activities there, and then we can go to some of the bigger issues, including looking at the role of Bolivia at the United Nations this past weekend, and generally.
Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting issue. And before we get into all that, and there are a couple of corrections I need to make about remarks that I've made in previous conversations, really just footnotes. One is that I just, without paying much attention to it, I just assumed that the Brazilian election was going to be late July, early August, but it's scheduled for October. And the other error that I've made in past conversations is that I just assumed that the legislative elections in Venezuela would be held quite close to the presidential elections, because that's the impression that was given a couple of months ago by President Maduro. But it turns out that there's no fixed date for the legislative elections in Venezuela. And the presidential elections are on May 20th.
Right.
Anyway, so I'm sorry for those minor errors. So then the a couple of things that are interesting in kind of sub-regional terms. And here in Central America over the weekend, there was a referendum in Guatemala on whether or not Guatemala should take a territorial claim against Belize to the International Court of Justice in Holland, in The Hague. And the yes vote won that, but with an incredible level of abstention, 76% abstention.
Really?
So, yeah, and so it's not clear at all what how legitimate or Now, most people in Guatemala obviously couldn't care less. And actually, the territorial claim against Guatemala seems to have been settled long ago in a treaty between the Guatemalan government and the then colonial authority, the United Kingdom. But let's mind that may be something to follow in months to come. Anyway, the other thing that's going on that is of interest is the election in Paraguay. That's, I think it's scheduled for next Sunday. And there, this is quite interesting for me because of the election result in Costa Rica recently, which is very similar in a way. In Paraguay, there are only two candidates, the traditional candidate of the right-wing party, the current president Horacio Cartes' party. In the polls, he looks as though he's the favorite, but I doubt that. And his opponent is the traditional Liberal Party candidate, the candidate of the traditional Liberal Party, supported by former President Fernando Lugo's Guasu Alliance. So now that election in domestic terms isn't very interesting, because just as in Costa Rica, domestic policy is unlikely to change very much. But it could be significant at a regional level if a candidate more sympathetic to Venezuela, and he should be if he's supported by Fernando Lugo, does win that election, and Paraguay might then not be a reliable right-wing ally either for the United States at an international level, or internally in South America for the Mercosur giant Brazil and its ally Argentina, who will then find that both the smaller countries within Mercosur are led by relatively progressive governments who are not amenable to an all-out regional assault in diplomatic and economic terms against Venezuela. So that could be significant after next Sunday.
Yeah, it's been 6 years since Lugo was yanked out of office, right? It was like 2012, I think, somewhere.
That's right. That's right. So I think it was 2012. Then subsequently the following year, Horacio Cartes won the election, mainly because the opposition was in complete disarray, because the Liberal Party back then that had been supporting the government of Fernando Lugo betrayed him and voted for his removal.
Right.
So they patched all that up.
Yeah. Well, Franco was president for like a year. He was the vice president, and then Cartes took office in I think was elected in 2013 under those conditions, with the right. You know, you essentially had the people who had engineered essentially a coup, a quote-unquote constitutional coup.
It was very much a prototype for what's happened subsequently in Brazil, for example. There's lots of other stuff going on, but I think we should try and talk if we can about the Americas Summit in Peru, the 8th Americas Summit.
Yeah.
In Peru, and I don't know, even if it was reported very much in the United States, it should have been, because there was the presence of the U.S. government in the form of Vice President Mike Pence, because Donald Trump was busy sending missiles into Syria.
Right.
And the significance of that summit is that it was very largely a failure in terms of the United States' attempts to galvanize more support against Venezuela, because that is the fundamental policy priority for the United States.
Yeah.
in Latin America at the moment, and they failed. Mike Pence had to sit through a categorical drubbing in verbal terms from the Cuban foreign minister Bruno Rodriguez, and if I have time, I'd love to translate that and post it somewhere, because it is a classic kind of taking apart of United States, of the absurd United States positions on Cuba.
Well, you know, the summits, just for so our listeners are aware of the fact, the summits of the Americas are essentially a product of the OAS. In other words, the U.S.-led, organized, based, hemispheric organization that was essentially operating for many years as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy and enforcement of the Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere. The summits of the Americas operate under the auspices of the Organization of American States.
Yeah, and I mean, the first summit was back in, I think, 1994 under Bill Clinton's presidential administration in the United States. And that was, I think that was actually held in Miami.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember the periodicity of with which they're held, but this one was the eighth.
Yeah, it's every 2 years. You had Miami in 94, Santa Cruz, Bolivia, 96, Santiago, Chile, 98. Quebec City, Canada, 2001. I don't know what they skipped a year. Mexico, Monterrey, 2004. Mar del Plata in Argentina, 2005. Port of Spain, Trinidad, Tobago, 2009. Cartagena, Colombia, in 2012. Panama City, 2015. And now this one in Lima for 2018.
Right. And of course, the one in the summits prior to the Mar del Plata summit were designed to prime the region for the United States strategic free trade area of the Americas.
Right. That's right. Which failed. And,
in 2005, that was totally blown out of the water by, as we've said in previous conversations, by Lula da Silva, Brazil, Nestor Kirchner Argentina, who was the president of Argentina at the time, and of course Hugo Chavez Frias, the president of Venezuela, and they just put together a consensus in the region, completely rejecting that free trade model of so-called free market model.
And Correa and Ortega and some others too.
Right, of course,
those are the prime movers, though, you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Now, and you're absolutely right to say that the Summit of the Americas is essentially an expression of whatever the configuration of power is as regards the organization of American states in the region. And it was very interesting to see that, and we can talk more about Bolivia later, but it was interesting to me that a couple of weeks before the summit, there was an ALBA meeting of foreign ministers that rejected the legitimacy of the summit because one of the main controversies around it was that former President Kuczynski, who had to resign because of accusations that he'd taken bribes from the big Brazilian company Odebrecht, and he withdrew the invitation to Venezuela. And at one point, Nicolas Maduro was thinking that he might attend anyway, but he decided not to, as did various other presidents. And it was the Summit of the Americas with the least number of presidents from the republics of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Including Trump. Trump didn't go. He sent Pence. Sent Pence. I mean, it's like sending, a chimpanzee with an organ grinder.
Right, sure. And Pence has very little credibility in the region.
Yeah.
And Trump has even less as a result of his outrageous policies against Mexico. And so the theme of the summit was democratic governance against corruption, that thing, which is, it's such a joke that you have attending that summit, Michel Temer and Mauricio Macri, who are two of the most corrupt leaders in the whole region. What? And there they were pontificating about corruption and its threat to democracy in the region, as if they are Democrats.
Well, this is what we've seen. There was an ideological struggle around the world, but in the region in particular, beginning perhaps in 1917 or earlier, but certainly in the post-World War II period and after the Cuban Revolution in January 1st, 1959, whatever date you want to start that. And It appeared for a while, you know, when they had suppressed Allende and some other things militarily, Guatemala in the early 50s, etc., that these guys won, that they won the positions of power, and even if you were to believe the media here, that they won the ideological struggle. That has completely and totally changed, and now they don't even engage in ideological discussion anymore, but rather it's about morality. It's about, yes, the problem is corruption, and what follows from that is the larger the state, the more of a magnet it is for corruption. So the only way they can sell this laissez-faire, you know, capitalist model that they like to impose, laissez-faire for us, and of course they have complete control of everything, is by saying that if you give anyone power to protect you, they're going to steal your wallet. I mean, that's yeah, kind of the logic of it.
Yeah, and that's the kind of strategy that the United States has been implementing for some time now, and right, kind of under the radar, as it were, because it wasn't clear until the coup against Fernando Lugo back in, as you said, in 2012, and that the subsequent development of that modality of undermining democratic governments via the judicialization of politics. And over the weekend, I translated another article by the Misión Verdad website in Venezuela that directly addresses that issue and points out that, as you and I have talked about in the past, there are within the United States alliance with its local elites, there are discrepancies and contradictions. Again, we'll also talk about that if we get a chance when we move on to talk more precisely about Bolivia. But what the article points out is that what the United States is doing is that whereas in the 1970s and early 1980s it relied on the military to discipline and keep in line,
right,
the region's countries, they are now using and exploiting and abusing and undermining the integrity of the judicial powers throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. And we've seen the way that's happened in Argentina in the case, for example, of Milagros Sala and the ridiculous accusations of high treason against Cristina Kirchner,
right,
that have now thankfully receded. And also we've seen it in Ecuador with the completely unjust imprisonment of a former vice president, Jorge Glass, on the basis of no evidence whatsoever except suspicion that he may have had an improper relationship with people who were in jail based on evidence in relation to corruption accusations. And that in Ecuador, that is now being developed. They're now developing a case against Rafael Correa, supposedly for mismanagement of Ecuador's national debt, when, as Correa himself has pointed out, all he did was harmonize Ecuador's public accounts procedures in accordance with the protocols of the International Monetary Fund. You know, so and then, of course, we have the whole situation around first Dilma Rousseff improperly removed from power on the basis of no evidence, right, whatsoever. And now we have the actual imprisonment of former President Lula da Silva also on the basis of no evidence whatsoever.
Right.
So it's a complete abuse and overthrow, if you like, of judicial integrity throughout the region, and that's right, that the United States is betting on that to be able to intimidate the local political classes, and not just the political leaders of the left wing or progressive forces and movements in Latin America, but also the right wing. And we've seen this Guatemala. For example, and also in Brazil to some extent, where Michel Temer has so far managed to face down and outmaneuver the attempts to indict him on corruption charges.
Right.
And also we've seen this in Guatemala, where
Jimmy Morales
is the president there, and he's managed to outmaneuver U.S. attempts to manipulate the U.N. Commission Against Impunity there, that has tried to work with local Jimmy Morales' local political enemies to indict him for corruption, so far without success. And we're seeing this also in Honduras, where there's a commission there against impunity, also I think it's an Organization of American States body, and they have they're in quite so far Juan Orlando Hernandez has completely outmaneuvered any attempts by them to undermine his control as the re-elected president, in complete contravention of Honduras's constitution. So, as the Misión Verdad article points out, there's this profound contradiction between right-wing leaders who resent this effort to intervene in their political life when they feel that they've got it under control in their favor. Elsewhere in the region, the right wing and the centrist parties, social democrat style parties, are very enthusiastic about using this modality to attack their political enemies.
Right.
And it remains to be seen how successful that U.S. policy will work out over the next few years. I think it won't be successful, but it remains to be seen.
Well, I mean, what you have in essence, if you think of not a static model, but rather the historical development of the area politically and institutionally, and actually with the two operating hand in glove, you had the various governments that were installed in essence by the United States over the last 50, 60 years. Military juntas, the whole bit, what happened in Brazil, what happened in Argentina, what happened in Bolivia, what happened, all over the region. And them falling off, Somoza in Nicaragua, on and on and on. And then the conditions that, gave birth to essentially leftish and or left governments being elected in a number of places there, and those policies being held out in front of the rest of the region and energizing a base for left politics across the region. Now, while that all happened, institutionally, you still have judiciaries that are products of the old regimes. They tend to be life appointments or much longer term appointments. They're supposed to be instruments of stability. And so if you're going to make mischief and use the levers of power that were based in the old relations, that's the place to go. And that's more or less what's been done. And it has the added benefit, as I mentioned before, of appearing to be non-ideological. So you don't have to come trying to sell an ideology that's been rejected by, at least half or damn close to half where they didn't elect the left, of the people on the ground, and use it as some moral or transcendent order that needs to be covered. In other words, this corruption is bad for everyone. It's not ideological. That person's a crook, no matter what they call themselves. Get them out of there.
Yeah, and obviously, if you can use that strategy to marginalize your main political opponents, then the electorates have only a very limited alternative, which is the one that you want the one that you want them to vote for. So
right,
and if you look at that, if you look throughout the region, where in the region are countries immune to this kind of false strategy? Well, they're immune to it in Cuba, obviously.
For sure.
And they're immune to it in Venezuela, because the Venezuelan constitution was completely overhauled in a 100% democratic way under Hugo Chavez Frias. You don't have that situation in Nicaragua, where the Frente Sandinista long ago saw that coming. And Daniel Ortega and his team deliberately trained up a whole generation of lawyers to be active participants in the country's judicial system. So they inoculated their judicial system against that kind of subversion.
Right.
And then in Bolivia, Bolivia completely overhauled its constitution again in a 100% democratic way under Evo Morales's government. And under their constitution, the judicial authorities get elected. And now that may change.
Right.
But so there too, you have a system that is inoculated against this kind of sinister attempt to subvert the judiciary that the United States has been able to implement successfully in other countries, most importantly in Brazil.
Yep.
So then, if shall we talk a bit more about Bolivia?
Yeah, Bolivia.
Bolivia has a very special role in the region currently, both at a global level, because it's currently a member of the UN Security Council. It's one of the revolving members of the UN Security Council, and it played a very important role in support of Russia, and to a lesser extent China as well, but in particular Russia, given the current situation in Syria. And it was in effect, it expressed the progressive point of view, the radical point of view, the revolutionary point of view,
yeah,
from Latin America and the rest of the world within the UN Security Council.
Yep.
That's one example of its role at an international level.
Yeah, very, really strong anti-imperialist tone to it, like unequivocal.
Yeah, and that is directly down to Evo Morales and his colleagues David Choquehuanca and yep. His vice president whose name I forget at the moment. They have a very clear anti-imperialist policy, both at a global level and at a regional level, it was interesting that Evo Morales, despite the fact that the Albert foreign ministers had a meeting a couple of weeks ago in which they rejected the legitimacy of the America's summit in Peru, Evo Morales attended the summit and Cuba attended the summit. Now, there are other reasons why those two countries decided to send high-level delegations to the summit. And one, in the Cuban case, they wanted to counteract the attempts by Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, to use the summit to attack Cuba via non-governmental organizations and
right.
so-called civil society. And in Evo Morales's case, he wanted to project at the highest level possible his rejection of Venezuela's exclusion from the Americas summit. But he was also taking advantage of his visit to Peru to engage in bilateral talks with the new Peruvian president who replaced Kuczynski, who had to resign as a result of corruption allegations.
Right.
but the other thing about Bolivia, so at a global level, let's talk about, if we've got time, let's try and talk about that quickly
yeah.
in a minute. But at a global level, Bolivia, of course, is also very prominent in the G77 plus China group, formulating trade and economic policy generally, and development policy in the United Nations. And also within the United Nations framework, they are very articulate spokesperson for majority world concerns around climate change.
Yep.
So at that level, Bolivia is playing a key role. And then at a regional level, as we can see in the event at the 8th America Summit in Lima over the weekend, and they're also playing a key role defending the progressive point of view and the progressive options on every possible subject against the current right-wing attempt to impose a neoliberal free market, a free trade for what that's worth agenda.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that is that in that summit, Evo Morales And this points to the contradictions that we were talking about earlier on between U.S. policy in the region and right-wing interests in the region. Right. Evo Morales consolidated an agreement with Peru about the transcontinental railway that is going to depart. Its starting point on the Pacific coast is the Peruvian port of Ilo. And Peru and Bolivia obviously plays a key role in that rail route because the route has to cross Bolivian territory and before entering Brazilian territory, reaching the Atlantic coast in the southern Brazilian port of I think it's called Santos.
Right.
Anyway, and the mere fact that. Despite all the contradictions, all the diplomatic contradictions, all the political contradictions, all the ideological contradictions, and the mere fact that Evo Morales participated in that summit and took part in the negotiations about that transcontinental railway, which is going to be financed by China, of course,
right.
Indicates that the United States is far from having things all its own way in Latin America, despite the propaganda to the contrary in the mainstream corporate media.
Yep, absolutely true. And it's going to be interesting to see how that goes, because as Morales negotiates with Peru over access, regaining access to the Pacific Ocean, you know, physically, this rail link provides exactly that. It's a matter of what's going to be the political and governmental and economic environment in which the stuff gets transshipped through what is now Peru into Bolivia from the Pacific, really between China and Bolivia, because I'm guessing China is going to have a pretty loud voice at that table about what the conditions will be.
Belt and Road Initiative Latin America.
That's exactly right. And we're going to stop there. Tony, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
You're welcome, Don. Thanks. Look forward to talking to you next week if we can.
Yes, we will. Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Well, welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The long-standing alliance between Pakistan and the United States is faltering, with Washington accusing Islamabad of supporting terrorism. How serious is this bet, and what will that mean for America's Afghan war? Well, I ask Imran Khan, member of Pakistan's National Assembly and the leader of Pakistan's Movement for Justice.
A new turn in the never-ending Afghan war saga. With the U.S. accusing its old ally Pakistan of backing Afghan militants, billions in American security aid to Islamabad are now frozen. Will Pakistan be now forced to go to China and Saudi Arabia for help? What effect will the Pakistan-American quarrel have on the war against the Taliban? And how damaging will the fallout with the Americans be for Pakistan's own internal struggle with terror?
Imran Khan, member of Pakistan's National Assembly and leader of Pakistan Movement for Justice, welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us today. Now, Mr. Khan, Pakistani Prime Minister Abbasi has just paid a visit to Kabul. Now, the Afghans, like former Afghan intelligence chief Amrullah Saleh, are saying that Pakistan views Afghanistan as a weaker state, and its relations with Afghanistan are driven by sheer greed and arrogance. How can you strike deals with Kabul if they view Pakistan this way?
This is very unfortunate, the remarks of the Afghan intelligence chief to define Pakistan's relationship with Afghanistan in these terms is actually very unfortunate, because Afghanistan needs Pakistan, and Pakistan needs peace, stability in Afghanistan. Otherwise, Pakistan gets affected, especially along the border, the what is called FATA, the tribal areas on the border of Afghanistan. So if you have problems in Afghanistan, instability, which sadly there has been for 16 years, Pakistan gets affected. So it's in Pakistan's interest that there's peace in Afghanistan. There is a problem there that, unfortunately, that the American policy of using a one-dimensional military solution to problems in Afghanistan has led to not only their longest war, but it has caused immense problems to Pakistan, because the border with Afghanistan is very porous. It is free movement, or there was free movement of people. And so what happens in Afghanistan affects Pakistan. So we need peace there, and I find these statements very sad.
I hear you. Talking about American policy, back in January, Donald Trump ordered billions of dollars in security aid to Pakistan to be frozen, accusing it of inaction in the war on terror. Former head of ISI, Asad Durrani, told me Pakistan's dependence on American aid ended a long time ago. So why then is your country's defense minister calling on the United States to reconsider the cut?
My point of view, this American aid has been very costly for Pakistan. For getting whatever aid we did get in these 15 years, the damage done to Pakistan in participating in the U.S. war on terror has led to almost 70,000 people dead. It has devastated our tribal areas, the border areas, where half of the population, where we are talking about 3 to 4 million people, were internally displaced. And the loss to the economy is over $100 billion. So this small aid has been very costly. And the lesson learned from Pakistan's point of view is never, never fight someone else's war. And people like us always opposed it. And Donald Trump does not understand. He does not understand the history of Afghanistan. Afghanistan has a history where they do not accept foreigners. They have always resisted foreign invasions. And if he had even drawn any lessons from the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, before that, the British in the 19th century, their invasion of Afghanistan, he would know that this military solution, which Donald Trump also has tried, is going to fail. The only solution, the only way to bring peace in Afghanistan is all the neighbors to sit together and then come up with a political solution. There is no other solution apart from that.
So U.S. government is saying that anywhere from 50 to 70% of the aid sent to Pakistan was misspent, wasted on kickbacks, bribes, even stolen. Meanwhile, the Pakistani foreign minister says that the country is ready to account for every single penny. In your opinion, like, once again, should there be more to this spat? I mean, should Americans put forth proof of corruption? Should Pakistan follow up and show actual accounting?
The aid given a proportion to the damage done in Pakistan by participating in the U.S. war, there is no comparison. The aid was what they say about $20 billion, maybe $25 billion. Pakistan has lost over $100 billion. Our economy suffered, investment suffered. The damage done through terrorism meant that foreign investors weren't coming to Pakistan. Our tourism collapsed in this country. Even today, foreign cricket teams do not come and play in Pakistan, sports teams. So this country took a heavy punishment by participating in that war. And the money, as I said, the money coming from aid is a small pittance compared to what it cost the people of Pakistan.
So you have said that Trump is briefed by and working for the agenda of Pakistan's enemies. Whose agenda would that be?
Well, the things that Donald Trump has said, he's actually applauded India's role in the war on terror. And he's actually blamed Pakistan for the U.S. not winning in Afghanistan. Now, and then he's blamed Pakistan for terrorism. Now, this is exactly what India says about Pakistan. And so, therefore, it was extremely hurtful for people of this country that they participated in a war that was not Pakistan's war. There were no Pakistanis involved in 9/11. Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan. There were no militant Taliban in Pakistan. How did we end up in a war where 70,000 Pakistanis have died? We still have terrorism in this country. We're still having the effects of this war on terror.
Mr. Khat, so are you saying India is duping American president into making the decision?
I don't know where he's come up with, but it's quite clear that the things he is saying is praising India, whereas India did not give any sacrifices in the war on terror. What role did India play in this whole war? It's Pakistan that took the battering, the suffering. And so to praise India is shocking for all of us. What has India contributed to this war on terror? And to give India a role in Afghanistan, India does not have a border with Afghanistan.
Pakistan's foreign minister says that the United States has turned Islamabad into a whipping boy to distract from its failures in Afghanistan. Do you agree? Is Washington looking to single out Pakistan to deter criticism?
Absolutely, I agree with it. Now, just look at the facts. At one point, there were 150,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. And then the Afghan army is anything between 250,000 to 300,000. So you're talking about almost 500,000 armed forces in Afghanistan. And what the US blames Pakistan is that 2,000 or 3,000 insurgents coming from Pakistan to Afghanistan are the reason why Afghanistan could not, they could not win the war in Afghanistan.
Can the drop in American aid be countered by deals with Pakistan's newest friends like China or Saudi Arabia? Are you expecting their influence to rise now that the United States is on a collision course with Pakistan?
Firstly, what would the U.S. do to be on a collision course with Pakistan? The maximum leverage the U.S. has is to stop the aid. Pakistan should try everything to keep the U.S. happy. But the problem is when the U.S. expects Pakistan to win the mess it has made in Afghanistan, it expects Pakistan to somehow win the war which they're badly lost in Afghanistan. And when I say lost, I mean they haven't won. All the Taliban have to do to win the war is not to lose. So what the U.S. expects Pakistan to do is what it has not been able to succeed in Afghanistan. And clearly, Pakistan has limitations. And if Pakistan, what they want to do is to take action against these Taliban groups supposedly operating from Pakistan, well, then they should tell us where are these groups. They're talking about the Haqqani network. At its peak, the Haqqani network would have maximum 2,500 men in Pakistan. That surely cannot be the reason why they've lost. They have not been able to win in 16 years. What I feel is that the American policy of military actions, collateral damage. I don't know whether you have seen in Kunduz, they bombed a madrasa, killed 100 children. Now that 100 children killed by American bomb means that this will raise hatred in Afghanistan, and hatred means more recruits. And so it's an ongoing circle. Collateral damage, hatred, more recruits, and an ongoing war. So the answer is that the U.S. has to change its strategy. And that's a going towards dialogue, political solution.
So the loss of USAID may not be a catastrophe for your country, but now Americans are considering provisionally putting Pakistan on the international terrorism sponsor list, the so-called gray list. You may think it is not fair to Pakistan, but how damaging would that be for the country and dangerous?
I think it's very unfair on Pakistan, a country that participated in the U.S. war. And I repeat, a country that had nothing to do with 9/11 and a country that lost more people than any other country. I mean, Pakistan lost more human beings, over 70,000 dead. Vast number of them handicapped because of bomb blasts, for helping the American, for joining the American war, it bore the heaviest cost. And in the end, for the Americans to then blame Pakistan and put sanctions on it, I think this is the greatest travesty of justice. I think, it is something which is inconceivable that the U.S. would, for its failure in Afghanistan, blame Pakistan.
But how damaging would it be, though? How damaging?
Well, it will be damaging. I mean, for Pakistan, unfortunately, our economic situation is not that strong right now. The country is actually going through an economic crisis. So American sanctions would be damaging. But, I mean, is this justice? Is it fair? Is this how U.S. would use a country like a tissue paper, and when it thinks it doesn't need it anymore, it just casts it away? I think it's very immoral.
All right, Mr. Khan, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Imran Khan, member of Pakistan's National Assembly and leader of Pakistan Movement for Justice, discussing tensions with Afghanistan and how this affects the power balance in the region. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Imran Khan, member of Pakistan's National Assembly and leader of Pakistan Movement for Justice, discussing Islamabad's faltering relations with the United States and their impact on the Afghan peace process. Mr. Khan, you said that Pakistan should fight terrorism for its own sake. Is Pakistan fighting terrorism for somebody else at the present moment?
Well, Pakistan started off fighting the U.S. war. I mean, there was no, as I said, there were no Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. There were no militant Taliban in Pakistan. We did not have the terrorism. We had sectarian terrorism, but that was just nothing compared to what happened once we joined the U.S. war on terror after 9/11. And then we had a spate of suicide bombing, which was more than in any other country. I mean, Pakistan suffered the sort of terrorism which no other country suffered. And there was a point in 2010-11 where, you know, the people were worried about the future of our country. We were falling apart. So it was thanks to our security forces that they eventually controlled this fanaticism and terrorism, which was because we were considered collaborators with the Americans. So all the anti-Americanism turned against Pakistan. So people were attacking Pakistan's security forces because they thought we were collaborating with the U.S. So the anger against the U.S. was borne by Pakistan.
Afghan politicians are openly saying that Pakistan is supporting the Taliban. It's become somewhat of an open secret, and even some former Pakistani officials are admitting to that, like Musharraf even. How can Pakistan be fighting terrorists with one hand and then supporting them with another?
Well, they're two different things. One are the so-called Taliban who are attacking Pakistan. Pakistani forces, security forces who are indulging in terrorism in Pakistan. On the other hand are the Afghan Taliban who are fighting in Afghanistan. Now, what Pakistan says is that the terrorism coming into Pakistan is from Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is saying that the terrorism coming into Afghanistan, or that they cannot win in Afghanistan because of the insurgents, which is Afghan Taliban, going in from Pakistani borders. My point is that clearly, first of all, there's a huge part of Afghanistan, some say 40%, some say 50%, which is not in the control of the Afghan government. So why would all these Taliban have to come to Pakistan if there is so much space available for them to operate from within Afghanistan? That's number one point. Number two, given that there is not going to be peace in Afghanistan unless there is a political settlement, so should not the Afghan government and the Americans be telling Pakistan to use their influence on the Afghan Taliban to get them for peace talks? So surely Pakistan's role right now should not be trying killing more people and creating more problems for a country that has taken the most beating, most suffering in the war on terror. Rather, it should be helping in the dialogue and the peace process with its influence on the Afghan Taliban.
Is Pakistan actually capable of getting its multiple militant groups under control on the Afghan border and in Kashmir? International community is saying that Pakistan tolerates militants, but does Pakistan have enough strength to eradicate them if you wanted to? I mean, the Pakistani Taliban are even listing you and your family as targets. Can they be stopped?
The Pakistan Taliban have their strength has been greatly reduced. Ever since the American footprint reduced in Afghanistan, the level of fanaticism went down in our country. No longer were Pakistani security forces supposed to be collaborators of the Americans. Hence, the recruitment for Pakistani Taliban went down and the fanaticism went down. And so Pakistani security forces have more or less controlled what is called the TTP, the Pakistan Taliban. Problem is in Afghanistan now. If Afghanistan is secure, settled, stable, then there would be peace in Pakistan. The problem is that because Afghanistan is unsettled, we keep having attacks from Afghanistan on the Pakistani soil right now. Because the Pakistani forces have controlled the Pakistani areas more or less now. There are still incidents, but much fewer. Problem in Kashmir, that for the last 25 years, there are almost 600 to 700,000 Indian troops in Kashmir. There are violations of human rights. The local population has turned against the Indian army. The people have risen up against India in peaceful protests. Now, India blames Pakistan for what is going on in Kashmir. In Kashmir, it is an indigenous struggle. This is not a struggle fueled by Pakistan. Why don't they give the Kashmiris right to decide what they want, what is their democratic right to decide their future? But they do not give them that right. They're using the forces to suppress that a democratic freedom struggle. And they blame Pakistan for what is going on in Kashmir, which again is unfair. Now, so we have two fronts. One is India blaming all what is happening in Kashmir on Pakistan. The other is the US and the Afghan government blaming for the instability in Afghanistan on Pakistan. That's the problem with Pakistan right now. Unfortunately, where Pakistan has failed, we did not project our point of view internationally on the diplomatic level. We have failed to really project what is happening in Kashmir. And at the same time, the sacrifices Pakistan has given in the U.S. war on terror, and Pakistan is not responsible for what is happening in Afghanistan.
You've said that if hundreds of thousands of NATO troops couldn't change the situation in Afghanistan, additional troops the U.S. is sending there annually is only going to prolong the agony. Do you mean to say that Afghanistan is finished as a state and should be left alone, die peacefully?
No, not at all. I think Afghanistan has a very proud history. Its people have suffered more than probably any other country. Because they've been suffering now almost 40 years. They've been suffering this conflict, strife, instability. And so if any people deserve peace, it's people of Afghanistan. And the only way that can be achieved is if all the neighbors sit on the table and bring the Afghan Taliban and the Afghan government on the table. That's the only way. Unfortunately, there is a... until very recently, the Americans were not willing to talk to the Afghan Taliban. Only now they have accepted that there should be dialogue. But this one-dimensional policy of just using military means to achieve peace, it had failed a long time back. There was a time when Obama came to power, and there was and Holbrook was the rep in Afghanistan. And he almost got the Taliban to sit on the table for a dialogue. But unfortunately, the surge spearheaded by Patriots, that surge is what sabotaged this peace talks. And actually, that led to more bloodshed. Now, Trump initially tried the same thing again, hoping that, you know, by attacking the Taliban, he would bring them to the table. But that's failed. And now I think there is a consensus everywhere that the only way peace can be achieved in Afghanistan is through dialogue and all neighbors sitting on the table. But that's the most important thing, to help the people of Afghanistan.
So, Hamid Karzai told me in a recent interview that Pakistan's policy towards his country is defined by its rivalry with India. Why is it so bad for Pakistan if Afghanistan becomes India's friend?
Well, it's because the signals coming from India are extremely aggressive. Ever since Mr. Narendra Modi's prime ministership, India has stanced towards Pakistan as not only aggressive, but the whole their foreign policy is to isolate Pakistan. Some of us in this country think that they even wouldn't mind Pakistan splitting, you know, breaking away Balochistan from the rest of the country. So clearly, Pakistan is worried that if they face India on two fronts, meaning, you know, long eastern border, and then if Afghanistan becomes an Indian satellite, which is the big fear with the Pakistan security forces, then Pakistan is struggling on two fronts. So it's out of this insecurity that Hamid Karzai is right. The policy is determined by security issues, yes.
So both countries, India and Pakistan, seeing how tense their relations are, have military plans for a conflict. Recently, Pakistan adopted a doctrine of using low-yield nuclear weapons in case of a major war with India. Is Islamabad really ready to use nuclear weapons on the Indian subcontinent?
That is the nightmare scenario. And that's why it's very important to resolve our differences, India and Pakistan, to sit on a table and have some sort of a roadmap to resolve their issues. Problem is, I repeat again, the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, his policy ever since he's come into power, it's extremely aggressive and it is hostile towards Pakistan, which obviously Pakistan being much smaller than India, it has made the country very insecure. The governments are insecure. Our security establishment is insecure. Bearing in mind that we are two nuclear-armed countries, the best way is that we sit down and resolve our differences. But unfortunately, so far, India's response has been arrogant and very aggressive. And whatever happens, the moment any sort of talks start or have in the past, one terrorist incident then derails the whole process. We are back to square one. What we really need is a strong, determined leadership in both the countries. A leadership that has the ability to take the pressure from that small lobby in both countries, which does not want peace. And come what may, whatever happens, whatever little incidents happen, the two countries stick to a roadmap of peace. And the peace has to be a resolution of the Kashmir issue. So unfortunately, at the moment, I don't see that dialogue happening. But in the future, it is the only solution that the two countries sit together and resolve this issue of Kashmir so that we can live side by side as civilized neighbors.
All right, Mr. Khan, thank you very much for this interview. Good luck with the elections. We were talking to Imran Khan, member of Pakistan's National Assembly and leader of Pakistan Movement for Justice, discussing the rift between Islamabad and Washington and its implications for the peace process in Afghanistan. That's it for this edition of Sophie & Co. I'll see you next time.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.